A big thanks to all of our undisclosed listeners for being with us for the past 5 years and supporting us by supporting our sponsors. Please continue to do so. Undisclosed started off with the Adnan Syed case more than 5 years ago, and we still aren't done with it. Adnan has been in prison now for 21 years, and after losing his appeals last year, is having to start over again with a new appeal process. That's right, we'll be back in court this fall. We are not giving up on this fight. But to help pay for this new appeal and for all the new investigation that's being done on the case, we have to relaunch his fundraising campaign. There are three ways to support Adnan. You can contribute any amount, once or as often as you like, at launchgood.com/freeadnan. You can also become a monthly supporter for as little as a dollar a month at patreon.com/freeadnan, where you'll find bonus content related to the case. And you can purchase newly designed and beautifully made Free Adnan merchandise at onemission.fund/support/freeadnan. If you didn't catch those, don't worry. We'll put them in the show notes and we'll post them on our social media as well. We need your support now more than ever. So thank you for it.
He gives you his car.
Mm-hmm. And he leaves his cell phone in the box.
Why does he give you his car?
So I can for use during while you're from school. But...
Hi and welcome to our redo of episode 3 of Undisclosed, The State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
As most of you are aware by now, January 13th, 1999, is the seminal date in this case. That's the day that Haman Lee would leave school and disappear forever. Today, we get to the heart of the state's case, the center of gravity in this murder charge against Adnan, a wormhole that warps timelines and maybe the most mysterious figure in the story, according to even Serial. Today, we look at Jay's day, but we begin by examining who Jay Wilds was.
Jay was a former Woodlawn High School student who graduated a year before Adnan and Hay. He knew them primarily because of Stephanie McPherson, his girlfriend. Stephanie and Jay had dated since middle school, and Stephanie had been friends with Adnan since middle school as well. Adnan and Stephanie were pretty close. They were in the same grade, they were in the magnet program together, and they'd been crowned the king and queen of the junior prom in the spring of 1998. So Jay was connected to Adnan through Stephanie, but the real question for a lot of people has always been, were Jay and Adnan friends? Now, according to the statements we have, both at trial and police statements, it doesn't really seem like it. Jay, Adnan, and Jennifer Pusateri, who is also a 1998 Woodlawn High School graduate, close friend of Jay's, and very much involved in the prosecution of the case, all either said to the police or in court that Adnan and Jay weren't actually friends.
You say Jay and Adnan were like best friends?
Oh, no. Not at all.
They were like casual acquaintances.
Casual acquaintances.
That was Jen being interviewed by the police in 1999. Now, here's Jay at trial on the stand in 2000.
What you said to them on the 13th was that you weren't really tight with Adnan.
No, that's correct.
And that was the truth back then, wasn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
You weren't really tight with Adnan.
No, ma'am.
You described him as an acquaintance, right?
Yes, ma'am.
As opposed to a friend.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
And that the only thing is that you might be at a party where he was. Is that right?
Once, yes, ma'am.
And that's what you told them.
Yes, ma'am.
We start Jay's day with Adnan dropping off his car with Jay, and we assume that before this time, Jay was basically at his home. The phone call record begins with a 10:45 a.m. call to Jay from Adnan's cell phone, after which Adnan left school and went to Jay's place. Remember, Adnan had a free period starting at 10:40 a.m., followed by lunch, so he had a couple of hours wide open. And up until this point, Jay and Anand agree basically on everything that happened. Though beyond that, there's pretty much almost nothing in common with their stories. While Anand's account of his day has been pretty consistent since 1999, the biggest problem with telling a story about Jay's day is that Jay has given a minimum of 8 different stories about what happened on January 13th. There were 4 police interviews, 2 trial testimonies, an interview he gave to The Intercept a few years ago, and finally, what he recently revealed to the filmmakers of the HBO series The Case Against Anand Syed. And simply put, these stories are not consistent at all. Despite the prosecution's claim at trial, there's no spine to Jay's story that holds it together. There's very little detail that's consistent across really even 2 of any of these stories by Jay. And even if we ignore the minor details, there's simply not consistency in the big picture of what Jay is telling to the cops, and eventually to the jury at trial. When we really break it down, there's only a few things that have been consistent through Jay's story, and they're pretty minor. The first is this. Jay consistently says that Hay's body was buried in Lincoln Park, although the time for this burial varies quite dramatically. Second, Jay does consistently say that at least one of the instruments that was used to bury Hay's body was a shovel. And he does say it came from one of his relatives' houses, but he doesn't say which house consistently across the interviews. Third, Jay does acknowledge that he had Anand's car and phone on January 13th. Fourth, and very interestingly, Jay does consistently say that he was at Jen's house on January 13th until at least 3:40 p.m., which, of course, is completely inconsistent with the state's theory of the case at trial, which is that Hay was killed by 2:36 p.m., which is when the Best Buy call took place. And then finally, Jay is consistent that at some point on January 13th, Anand showed him Hay's body in the trunk of her Sentra, although both the time and the location of this trunk pop vary quite meaningfully across his interviews and testimony.
And so when we look at these consistencies in Jay's story, they really mean nothing without any structure that holds the story together. For instance, the shovels. Sometimes he says there was one shovel, sometimes it's 2 shovels, sometimes there's a pick involved. Sometimes he's helping to bury the body, sometimes not. Whose house do they come from? Were they from his mother's house, his grandmother's house? And likewise, we have all these various stories about the trunk pop, the time he alleges Anand opened up the trunk of Hay's car and showed him the body. Where did that take place? Was it at the Woodlawn Library? Was it a strip off of Edmondson Avenue? Was it Franklin Town Road? The Best Buy? Was it at a pool hall, as he told one of his friends? Or at a gas station? Was it at his grandmother's house? Because he's mentioned all of these locations in different versions of his story. And he's given different time frames for each of these versions, ranging from right after he meets Anand at Best Buy to as late as midnight that day. And so if we look through all of these stories, they vary wildly. Then in the 2014 Intercept interview, he actually says he lied to the police initially and told them the trunk pop happened at Christy Vinson's house. And Christy Vinson, by the way, is a woman known as not her real name Kathy in the podcast Serial. Well, if that's true, that's one more version, and it's a version the state never disclosed to the defense. When we try to decipher what Jay is saying in these various statements, it's almost meaningless to do so because these accountings are so very different. And in fact, he's admitted himself that he has lied in various statements about the events of January 13th, so there's not much you can do with him. Which then leaves us with 2 things that we can look at in trying to decipher what aspects of Jay's day might actually be reality.
The first is to look at other witnesses and what they have to say about interacting with Jay on January 13th. And the second is to see the evolution of Jay's story, where it started and how it got from point A to point Z when he eventually testified at trial, and then his statements more recently. We only have statements from 2 witnesses other than Anand who say they saw Jay on January 13th, and that's Jen Pusateri and Christy Vinson. Though as we explained in Anand's Day episode, we're fairly certain that Christy didn't see Jay or Anand on the 13th at all. We'll look at the following events. First, when Jay went over to Jen's house in the morning. Second, what did Jen and Jay do while he was at her house? Third, when did Jay leave her house? Next, when did Jen and Jay meet up again later that evening? And finally, what did they actually do that evening? So first, when did Jay get to Jen's house? According to Jen, she called Jay sometime between 10 a.m. and noon that day to invite him to come over to hang out. After work, she went home, and you know, maybe an hour later, Jay showed up.
So I want to say I got home probably between 12:30 and 1. And then I want to say that Jay got there probably between 1 and 1:30. Maybe as late as 2, but I don't think it was that late. I think it was more around 1:30 time.
That was Jen talking to the cops. So Jen says that she got home first, and later Jay walked in. Jay says the exact opposite. He says he went over to the Pusateri home, not to hang out with Jen, but to hang out with Mark, Jen's little brother.
Was anybody home?
Yes, her brother was.
Did you have the occasion to go inside?
Yes, we entered, we went down the basement, we played video games, probably for about half an hour before anyone called.
Was Jennifer home?
Not yet.
What time does she get home?
She gets off work at about 12:30, takes her... She lollygagged in the house at, say, probably about 1:30.
So which one is it? Did Jen call Jay to tell him to hang out with her that afternoon? Or did Jay go to the Pusateri house to hang out with Mark, and Jen just happened to show up later? Second, what did Jay and Jen do while Jay was at the Pusateri residence? Turns out that Jay and Jen can't even agree on that, and so both of them do mention playing video games at some point, but other than that, they don't really agree on anything else. And so, according to Jen, Jay and she were actually at her place all afternoon, and Jay never left. But according to Jay, he actually left multiple times. In addition to that, they also don't have agreement on the phone calls that Jay received while he was at Jen's house. When Jay testifies at trial, he remembers that both Adnan and Jen were calling him while he was at Jen's house. First of all, if Jen is at the house with him, why is she making calls to Jay? Furthermore, if you look at the phone log between noon and 3:30 p.m., we have 3 calls that are made to Jen's home phone from Adnan's cell phone. So if Jay is at Jen's house, why is he calling her? Jen doesn't really contradict Jay's statements about the phone calls. She really just simply doesn't remember them. And so when the cops tell her about the phone calls, they're the ones who are telling her they took place on January 13th. But Jen herself actually doesn't remember these calls happening on the 13th.
You indicate several phone calls come into your residence. However, you're not sure whether it was Jay's cell phone or the telephone.
Right. I don't even remember the phone name, but you told me that he called my house. So apparently it was either on the cell phone or on my house line number.
Okay. Jen's memory of the day is actually pretty hazy, and according to Jay, that shouldn't be the case because Jay gave her big news.
Do you have any conversation with her about what is going to occur?
Yes. Later that afternoon, we had went out to her car. I think we'd ran to the store, come back to get some soda or something like that. And we were sitting in her car, and I told her that I think that Adnan was going to kill Hay.
According to Jay then, Jen really didn't react. Jen really didn't care much about what Jay had to say about Adnan's plans to kill Hay.
You took it so seriously that you told Jennifer.
Yes.
And what did Jennifer say?
I don't think she believed me. I don't remember exactly what she said, but I don't think she believed me.
Jennifer really never liked Kay, correct?
Yeah.
Did she actually even care?
Not really.
Did she say, you know, oh, I can't believe this, we've got to stop this?
No.
What did she say to you?
That motherfucker's crazy.
And that's it.
According to Jay, maybe Jen's lack of surprise about the news was because he had actually already told Jen about Adnan's plans to kill Hay the prior day.
He returned me to my house. I paged Jennifer Pusateri. I paged Jennifer Pusateri. We had went to Gilston Park. She had her dog with her. There I told her what the conversation me and Adnan had had earlier that day. And her reaction was just about the same. And then later that day, I went to Champs, celebrated my birthday.
So either Jay is lying about telling Jen of Adnan's plans to kill Hay, or it's Jen who's lying about her knowledge of the murder plot. But any way you slice it, we have Jen and Jay telling completely different stories about what happened when they hung out in the afternoon of January the 13th.
One point that Jay and Jen firmly agree on is when Jay left Jen's house that afternoon. The problem, as we pointed out earlier, is that they both agree Jay left Jen's house at a time that completely invalidates the state's timeline. Both Jen and Jay say over and over again that he left the house at 3:30, 3:40, and Jen even says it could have been as late as 4:15 p.m. even. But the state's theory of the case is that Hay was dead by 2:35 p.m. and the come-and-get-me call was made at 2:36 p.m. In his second police interview, Jay actually says that Anand's promised come-and-get-me call actually never even came in while he was at Jen's house.
I had only called on the hardline while I was at Jen's house.
Okay.
He told me he was going to need me to pick him up at a certain time. That was 3:30. I waited till 3:30. He didn't call. I left the house with his car and cell phone.
So Jay says that at 3:30 p.m., Anand hadn't called like he said he would. So Jay just decided to leave. He headed to his friend Jeff's house, but before he got to Jeff's door, Anand did call, and that's when the come and get me, the bitch is dead call happened. But in his first interview, here's what Jay said about that.
You're playing this waiting game, waiting for him to give you a call.
Mm-hmm.
Does he call you at some point in time?
Yeah.
What time does he call you?
Time I remember talking to him, like actually having a conversation with him, was about 3:40 something.
So here we have Jay saying that the come and get me call was at 3:40 p.m. He is very consistent on this point. There's pretty much nothing else that Jay manages to say in almost every interview this consistently. And Jen agrees with him. She also says that Jay left her house that day at 3:40 or later.
He was going to come around 3:30. So we hung out at my house. And then I guess around 3:30, 3:45, Jay got a call. And then I don't know what was said during the conversation. Then Jay got another call. Well, we got off the phone, and then another call came in. And I don't know whether it was the same person or who it was. And I don't know whether it was on my phone or whether it was on the cell phone that Jay had. Then Jay left my house probably around 3:34, 4:15, after 3:45, between 3:45 and 4:15.
So this is the one point where Jay and Jen's stories coalesce. And that's significant because if we believe this, it again completely undermines a couple of key components in the state's case. Clearly, that means there was no 2:36 p.m. come and get me call. But also, what about the call the Serial podcast referred to as, quote, the Nisha call? A call that was made from a non-cell phone to a girl he was dating named Nisha. That call was placed at 3:32 p.m. Well, if both Jay and Jen say that Jay was still at Jen's house until at least 3:40 p.m., that means that Jay, who had the cell phone, made the Nisha call. And if we look at Jay specifically, this isn't simply a matter of, well, maybe he was wrong about the time. Jay very specifically says, quote, I was waiting for a call at 3:30 p.m. That call didn't come till later. It's not just him guessing the time. He has a very specific signpost as to why the call he was waiting for was after 3:30. And second, if we look at Adnan's call log, there isn't an incoming call anywhere around 3:40 p.m. The last call before that is at 3:15 p.m., and the next one is at 4:30 p.m. So Jay and Jen's story about Jay getting this call from Adnan at or around 3:40 p.m. or so doesn't match up with any recorded call on Adnan's call log. Which means that really the only detail about Jay's trip to Jen's house that has their stories matching up either has to be false, or the state's narrative about the come and get me call, the Nisha call, and about when Jay went to Best Buy, well, it's all made up. You have to ask though, why are Jen and Jay both sticking to this point? We know Jay will change his story. Why not here? Why is he always sticking to 3:40 p.m.? Well, that's kind of an important part of their tale, because that's their alibi. Jen and Jay were together until 3:40 p.m., a time when we know that Hay had already been intercepted and was probably already killed, because remember, she didn't make it to pick up her cousin from the elementary school. So if Jen and Jay were together until 3:40 p.m., like they say, then neither can be responsible for her murder. Are you fascinated and terrified by cases of missing people? And are you also looking for a new true crime comedy podcast to take your mind off of things? If so, I am super excited to tell you about Obsessed With Disappeared, a brand new true crime comedy podcast from the people who make the hilarious True Crime Obsessed podcast. You know them, Patrick Hines, one of my favorite people in the world, one of my favorite podcasters. He makes TCO with Jillian Pensavalli, but this new podcast he's making with his best friend of 20 years, Broadway diva Ellen Marsh. Using humor, sass, and heart, every episode recaps an episode of everyone's favorite true crime show, IDs Disappeared. If you're serious about true crime and you also love to laugh, you're going to love Obsessed With Disappeared. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to subscribe today.
According to Jay, Adnan calls him, he meets him at Best Buy, and then there are a few different versions of what happens next. And for the sake of this story again, we'll have to ignore the fact that Jay simultaneously maintains this call allegedly took place at 2:36 p.m. and he left Jen's house immediately, but also that he was at Jen's place until 3:40 p.m. Anyhow, Jay says he drops Adnan back off for track practice, and Adnan calls him again after it's done to pick him up. Adnan, however, says that no such thing ever happened. He never left the school campus until after track practice. Now, if you recall from episode 1, it seems that Adnan was at track that day on time at 3:30 p.m., and that track ended around 5:30 p.m. This coincides with the call patterns in the cell log. At 5:14 p.m., there's a call to the phone that goes to voicemail. But at 5:38, a call is made to Krista, who's a friend of Adnan's, which means at this point Adnan, Jay, and the phone are probably all together. Jay, in fact, does initially tell the police they went to get food after practice, they smoked pot, and then the whole Christy Vincent episode comes in. So it seems clear from the call records that Jay and Adnan parted ways by around 8 p.m. But before that, they were together for a couple hours, during which Adnan received a call from Hay's brother and then spoke to Officer Adcock, who was at Hay's house. After Jay left Jen's house, whenever that happened, Jen went to pick up her parents from work, and she got back home around 6:30 p.m. Both Jay and Jen agree that they saw each other again that evening, but the two of them don't come close to remembering the same things about what happened that evening or what they were doing. Jay tells the cops that after the burial in Lincoln Park, and after Adnan abandoned Hay's car at the vacant lot on Edgewood Road, he and Adnan stopped by Westview Mall to toss some shovels or shovel or a pick in a dumpster, and then Adnan dropped Jay off at his house. And it's only there that Jen calls him.
He's my friend Jen. Back to page her from his phone to my house. I get out of his car, I go in my house. Jen calls me back, I tell her I need to talk to her. It's real important for her to come get me. She comes right over. I take my clothes from that day, I put them in a plastic bag. I go out to the car with Jen, I tell her what happened.
But then there's an entirely different version of events, the version the prosecution argues at trial and what's presented in serial. In this version, Jen picks Jay up from Westview Mall. Jay and Adnan were sitting in the parking lot of the mall in Adnan's car, and then Jay got into Jen's car. You might remember that in this version, Adnan allegedly said, "Hey, what's up, girl," to Jen when they saw each other. But that version doesn't ever come from Jay. That's all Jen's story.
Then I guess a little bit after 8, around 8, between 8 and 8:30, I'd say Jay paged me and told me to come pick him up at Westview Mall parking lot in front of Value City. I got to Westview Mall parking lot in front of Value City, probably between 8 and 8:30, shortly after the page came through.
So Jen says she picked up Jay from the mall, and the prosecution goes with her story at trial. But Jay was clear. He went right home after the burial, and Jen picked him up from his house. And him going to the mall to meet Jen wouldn't make any sense because he needed to change clothes. He had dirt in him from the burial. But according to Jen, when she got Jay from the mall, there was no sign he'd been busy in the woods burying a body.
You notice anything about his clothing? That they were disheveled, soiled, or anything like that?
No, they didn't look dirty. They didn't look any different than they normally looked. Than it looked before, like when he was at my house at 1 or 1:30. They didn't look any different than then.
Here's what Jay said happened after Jen picked him up from home.
On the way up.
Jen had come over to your house to pick you up.
Uh-huh.
You told her what had occurred.
Yes.
And you got in the car with her.
Yes.
And you were going to
dump your clothes, yes.
Jen also says that she helped Jay throw away the clothes that he was wearing while burying the body in Lincoln Park. But she doesn't say it happens that night in the 13th. She says that whole event doesn't happen till the next day, the following afternoon, when she picks Jay up after work.
I woke up the next morning. I guess I went through my normal 6:30 to till 9 routine, taking everybody to work, myself getting to work. And I think I probably went to work the next day, as long as it wasn't a Saturday or Sunday. And then sometime during the 14th, on that day, I went to see Jay again at his house. I picked him up, and he had his boots with him, as well as his clothes and jacket that he had on the night before. And he asked me if I would take him to F&M parking lot.
Which brings us to the question of the rest of the evening of January 13th. What did Jay and Jen do after she picked him up? Not surprisingly, Jay and Jen also disagree on what happened for the rest of the evening. Though there is one point actually they agree on, and that's that they went to visit Stephanie around 8:30 p.m. So let's look first at Jen's statement about what happened that evening.
He was like, "You have to take me to go see my girlfriend now." I took him. I think I took him to see Stephanie because he was very concerned for Stephanie's well-being.
And next, let's look at Jay's statement about the same period of time.
From there,
yes.
Where did you go?
From there, I went to my girlfriend Stephanie's house. She had a late game. I stopped. It was her birthday. I spoke to her. We chatted for a little bit. Then we left there, and I went to Chrissy and Jeff's, where I remained for the rest of the evening.
The problem with this is that even though Jay and Jen both do agree that they went to Stephanie's house after they wiped down the shovels at Westview Mall, their stories simply can't be true. That's because we know that Stephanie had a basketball game on the evening of January 13th, and that she didn't get home from that game until 10 o'clock. According to Stephanie herself, it wasn't until 11:30 p.m. that night when Jay finally stopped by her house. And here's the interesting thing. We've been told this whole time that the entire purpose of Jay borrowing his car was for him to go get a birthday present for Stephanie. But according to Stephanie herself, Jay didn't even give her the present until the next day. That contradicts both Jay and Jen, who both say that they went to see Stephanie at around 8:30 p.m. And so that leaves the question of what exactly were Jay and Jen doing during that hour and a half between 8:30 and 10 o'clock. After this supposed trip to Stephanie's house, Jay says that he and Jen go to visit Christy Vinson. But Jen says that after Stephanie's, she and Jay went to a party with her sorority sisters and her friend Mike.
Did you go to Christy's house or did you go to
Christy's house? No, I think I went to Candace before I went to Christy's house.
And Jay was with you?
Yes, Jay was with me.
And where is the campus?
UMBC, Wilkins Avenue.
Within the campus, how long did you stay at the sorority house?
I want to say we were there maybe about an hour. We didn't stay as long as I wanted to, but that's because we still had to get to Christy's house. I tend to make a lot of plans and have to go a lot of places because I have a lot of friends that like to hang out, I guess. I try to make everybody happy. It was my friend Mike's birthday. He was giving me a hard time about leaving because he was like, I never hang out long enough, and blah, blah, blah. But I left anyhow. And after I left there, I went to Christy's house.
We have to point out for a moment how odd this is. Jen has supposedly just learned that someone she knew has just murdered someone else she knew. And her first concern is to make sure she doesn't miss her friend Mike's party. While it's true she never really liked Hay anyway, but Jen's reaction to Jay's news is baffling. Of course, Jay says that this whole post-murder sorority trip never even happened. So Jen lied, or maybe she was mistaken. He says both things at trial.
You never told the police about going to the sorority party, did you?
No.
You didn't tell them on the 28th, right?
No.
And you didn't tell them on the 15th of March, right?
No.
And you didn't tell them on the 13th of April, right?
No.
And you didn't tell them on the 9th, the 7th of September, did you?
No.
And you didn't tell them at any time, did you?
No, ma'am.
And that's not the truth, is it?
That I went to a sorority party?
Well, what is the truth you would have us believe is that you did go to a sorority party, right?
No, ma'am.
Yeah, that's something that your very good friend Jen says, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so to summarize, Jay and Jen agree they went to Stephanie's shortly after Jay got picked up, but that part of the story can't be true because Stephanie wasn't home then. Then Jen says they went to a party at UMBC and then went to Christy and Jeff's place, but Jay says he went to Christy's immediately. Christy also says that Jen and Jay came back to her place later that night, but we know that there's a good reason to think she might have been wrong about that day because of the conference reference and because of Christy's class schedule, which we covered earlier. So could Jen have also been thinking of the wrong day, a day when Stephanie might have been home around 8:30 p.m.? It's possible. Now, on the other hand, Jay and Jen's story do match up at some points and have some very rough overlaps, even if they diverge on details. So does that mean Jen is actually corroborating Jay? Well, the answer to that is no, because Jen and Jay's stories were not given independently. When the cops interviewed Jay, they told him about what Jen had said and where his statement was consistent with hers. Now, this doesn't happen in the tape portion of the police interview, so we know it had to have happened in the pre-interview, which means Jay was given an opportunity to alter and adapt his statement so that it was in line with what Jen had said. And that's not just conjecture. Jay actually testifies to this on the stand.
During that interview, they confronted you with things that Jay Cusateri said.
Yes, ma'am.
And you knew more about her interview with the police because they told you about it.
Yes, ma'am.
They advised you that during what they called the first interview, that there were a lot of inconsistencies. Did they not?
Yes, ma'am.
And they then asked you to address them. Did they not?
Yes, ma'am.
So that means that the fact that Jay and Jen both said something isn't necessarily proof that the thing actually happened. Could have easily been the result of the police telling Jen what Jay said, and then them telling Jay what Jen said. That brings us then to the final witness who apparently saw Jay on January 13th, and that's Mark Pusateri, Jen's brother. And as we know, Jay, in his first and second police statements, said he went over to the Pusateri residence to hang out with Mark and not Jen. And according to Jay, Mark and he played video games together, made a trip to the mall, and it wasn't until later that Jen got home. Here's the big problem, the big gap or omission we have in this case, which is to say, we have no idea what Mark has to say about the events of January 13th. According to the state's records, there was never any interview between the police and Mark. And so this person, whom according to Jay, is the reason why he went to the Pusateri house, was never talked to by police to determine whether in fact Jay was telling the truth. This seems crucial because Jay, in his very first recorded interview, says, quote, "Yeah, Mark Pusateri saw me. We played video games together." If he's using that as an alibi for the murder, you'd have to think he was confident that Mark would back him up. So why wouldn't the police talk to Mark to at least confirm these basic details? There's a couple possibilities. First, the police did talk to Mark, but Mark wasn't helpful to their investigation, so they ditched him. Or, they never even bothered because they knew there was no point in corroborating something that may have been a lie. After all, we all know that Jay lies. Everyone knows he lies. Jay admits he lies. The real enigma here is why.
The first time I realized that Susan Simpson might be the person who actually solves what happened in this case was when I read a blog she wrote about Jay's police statements. Now, I've had these statements for years. You know, I've looked at them, I've read them and reread them, and I always thought, well, something is really wrong here. It's all so wrong. What is going on here? Jay lies, he admits it, but no one, not even Sarah Koenig, could figure out why he lied. What was animating these lies? What's the utility of these lies, and what is the method behind this madness? And then bam, Susan figured it out. She figured out what no one else in all these years, not even Serial, could figure out. Because all this time we have been trying to plot Jay's dream. But it turns out it was never his dream to begin with.
If you've read my blog, you know that I spent a lot of time analyzing Jay's interview statements. There's a lot of weird stuff in there, but when you read a transcript, the context for a lot of statements can be lost. When parts of the dialogue don't seem to make sense or don't add up, you're left wondering if there's some sort of tone of voice or some inflection or something in there, or something else about the interaction that could explain why they're saying the things they said. So when I finally got the audio for Jay's interviews, I was pretty excited. And the first thing that stood out to me was the pauses. They're long, they're frequent, they don't show up in the transcript. So before, I'd had no idea exactly how long Jay had been waiting in between answers, and how he just didn't know what to say a lot of the time. You just hear these 10, 15, 20 seconds of him apparently thinking of how to answer a question, and those pauses don't show up in the transcripts because they just show what he said without the gaps. And then I noticed something else. The same thing kept happening over and over again. To show you what I'm talking about, let's play a clip from one of the interviews. Here's Jay describing what happens after he and Anon go to Patapsco State Park to smoke weed. Or as Jay put it, to go rockin' in the park.
Okay. What happens then?
We leave there, I believe. Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to schooling, and I dropped him off.
Did you catch that? Jay's responding to someone after that pause. And not just that. There's a tap tap. And then Jay says, oh, okay. And suddenly, a moment later, he knows the answer. I first heard the tapping after I listened to the clips a few times, and then shortly after that, I found a document in the police file that seems to correlate with those tappings. And I spent a lot of time listening and re-listening, trying to make sure I wasn't hearing something that wasn't there, or that this wasn't a tapping that appeared all over the interviews in all kinds of places. But again and again, the pattern held. Jay gets confused in answering a question. He pauses too long or starts to say the wrong thing. And then tap, tap, tap. Suddenly, Jay knows the answer. So finally, I got the clips together and sent them to Amar, our sound editor. And I asked him to make sure that those sounds were really there. He cleaned up the audio for me, and yeah, those sounds are there. Let's play that same clip again, but this time with the audio cleaned up.
Okay. What happens then?
We leave there, I believe. Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there. I took him back to schooling.
Jay forgot what happened after Patapsco. He didn't remember that the next sequence of events involved him taking Anon to track practice so that Anon could set up an alibi. But then a tapping reminds him.
Can you bear with me for a minute? Okay, we left there.
To show what this tapping here is actually doing, let's look at another clip. This one's from the first interview, and it's describing what happens after Anon and Jay leave Edmondson Avenue and head up towards the park and ride.
Anon follows me, and so I get in the car and I follow him, and we end up at the 70 park and ride off of,
What is that, Jay says.
What is that?
It sounds like Jay's referring to something, like a map. In fact, there are a series of maps in the police file with the cell towers labeled and the times of key calls scribbled in. These maps don't display most road names, but they do list some of the roads, and Cook's Lane is one of the roads labeled there, leading directly to the park and ride. In fact, almost without exception, in his interviews, the only roads that Jay is capable of naming are the roads that are displayed on this map. Here's what Jay says when he's asked to describe what happened when Patrick didn't answer the phone. That's the 3:59 p.m. call that Jay says was him trying to find weed. Now, in this clip, listen for the paper shuffling that occurs just as Jay switches to the part of the story involving the trip to Forest Park to try and score weed.
What do you do then after Phone message.
We head to Forest Park to see if we can find a corner salesman there. We go down there, we buy two dime sacks. We turn around. I believe we stop to get blunts on Rogers and Gwinoak and Rogers, in the corner of Gwinoak and Rogers.
Again, we have a long pause, and suddenly Jay comes up with the answer. He names a corner, Rogers and Gwinoak's. And for a guy who says he doesn't really know street names, that's oddly specific. Also, it never came up in his first interview, so how is he suddenly now recalling the name of the corner that he didn't know back then? Well, it turns out that among the roads listed on those maps, in the Forest Park area, there are only a couple of corners that are named, and yeah, Gwinoak and Rogers are among the two most prominently displayed. In the next part of the interview, Jay describes how he went to meet Anon off of Edmondson Avenue after getting the come and get me call. Jay immediately starts talking about how he then followed Anon to some other location, and he's jumping to the part of the story where they go to the park and ride. But the detectives stop him. They prompt Jay to get back on track and to tell about the next important event in the story.
You arrived 20 minutes later, this location on Edmondson Avenue. Then what happened?
I followed him out.
Did you get out of your car when you get on Edmondson Avenue and have any conversations with him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about that.
We got out. He's walking around with gray gloves on.
Gray gloves, are they?
Winter gloves.
Cloth gloves? Or?
Yeah, they're like wool with leather palms. And that spark, I'll be walking around with gloves on for it. And then, I'm sorry. He goes, I did it. You don't fucking believe me? I did it. And he pops the trunk open, and he's like, he's all bent up and ballooning the trunk.
Okay, in case you didn't catch that, listen to that last part one more time. Jay started making up some conversation that he'd had with Anon about his gloves, a conversation that Jay never ever mentions again and has no point or apparent relevance to the story. The cops don't like it. They stop him. And midway through, Jay changes the direction of the story.
He's walking around with gray gloves on.
Gray gloves, are they?
Winter gloves.
Cloth gloves, or?
Yeah, they're like wool with leather palms. And that spark, I'll be walking around with gloves on for it. He goes, I did it. You don't fucking believe me, I did it. And he pops the trunk open, and he's like, he's all bent up and ballooning the trunk.
First, Jay apologizes.
I'll be walking around with gloves on for it, and then, I'm sorry.
Why is he apologizing? Because, most likely, someone in that room is giving him a look or a stare, letting him know that he screwed up. He got it wrong. Then you hear a tap-tap sound. And Jay says the word pops, but in a way that makes it sound like he's reading it.
Pops. He goes, I did it. You don't fucking believe me? I did it.
And then, with sudden confidence, Jay launches into the story that he'd forgotten before, with the part about how Anon pops the trunk open and shows him Hay's body. Another thing that I've discussed on my blog is how convoluted Jay's whole story about the burial really is. It's way over elaborate and involves 3 or 4 trips back and forth from the parking spot to the burial site and involves an extremely inefficient series of events. And in his interviews, Jay can't keep track of it all. He repeatedly gets confused trying to describe where all these pieces are moving about, trying to describe where the shovels are, where the car is, where Anon's car is, where Hay's car is. And he often seems to forget that one of the cars exists at all, and he'll end up describing how Anon was walking around the streets, not remembering that Anon should have had Hay's car at the time and should have been driving around in it. So when Jay tries to describe in the interview where Hay's car is located, guess what we hear again? That's right. Tap, tap, tap.
And both cars are parked back in the parking spot?
No. Just his car. Her car had been moved to the spot around the corner prior to us digging the hole.
Let's play that cleaned up again so you can hear it better. We have Detective McGillivray asking Jay where the cars are and trying to remind Jay that are they parked there in the parking spot? And Jay says, well, no, her car is... dot, dot, dot. And suddenly, Jay knows that her car is around the corner. And this spot is shown on the detective's maps. You can see the burial site, and you can see the road where it does this kind of dogleg back towards where the cars are supposed to be. And someone's tapping on that corner.
And both cars are parked back in the parking spot?
No. Just his car. Her car had been moved to the spot around the corner prior to us digging the hole.
The detectives are not shy about reminding Jay how many cars he's supposed to have at any point in the story and where those cars are supposed to be. But as the interview goes on, they start getting less and less subtle about it. In fact, Detective McGillivray starts sounding downright exasperated, and we don't really blame him for it because Jay screws up quite a bit. So Jay makes his umpteenth mistake of the day, and you can hear the frustration from both detectives.
What do you do then?
We drive to Westview. I told him to take me home. And on the way going home, we passed by Westview, and he said, I better get rid of this stuff.
You've got two cars.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm missing car spots. Yes, I'm sorry. We leave. We still do have two cars. He motions for me to follow him. I follow him. We're driving around all in the city. I ask him, where the hell are we going? And he says, where's a good strip at? I need a strip.
McGillivray reminds Jay that they've got two cars, and Jay apologizes and adopts this new story. It's worth noting, though, that Jay almost immediately forgets once again that there are two cars in the story. Did you hear where Jay starts describing a conversation that he and Anon had while they're driving around in two separate cars? Apparently, Anon was able to telepathically communicate with Jay during this whole series of events.
He motions for me to follow him. I follow him. We're driving around all in the city. I ask him, where the hell are we going? And he says, where's a good strip at? I need a strip.
But the two-car issue aside, Jay makes a really interesting comment during this exchange. In response to McGillivray's exasperated sighs, Jay says, I'm missing, and top spots.
You've got two cars.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm missing car spots. Yes, I'm sorry. We leave. We still do have two cars. So
what on earth is Jay referring to? I'm missing top spots? Well, it turns out that the police file doesn't just have maps. There's also a document called Jay's Chronology. It has a numbered list of 24 events about what occurred January 13th, and event number 22 starts at the very bottom of the first page and continues on to the second page. It says, Jay and Honda follows Anon and Nissan to 300 Edgewood, where Nissan is dumped. So what is Jay missing, and what are the top spots? Could it be that Jay meant he was missing page 2 of the chronology, and then when he found where page 2 was, he was reading off the top spots of it? It sounds like it. Now, there's also another indication in the interviews that Jay is following off the chronology. For example, let's take what happens after Anon receives the phone call from Officer Adcock. According to the Jay's Chronology document, the next two events are numbers 16 and 17. Number 16 says, Anon asked Jay to help get rid of the body. They drive to Jay's house, get shovels, then to park and ride. And number 17 says, Jay and Honda follows Anon and Nissan to Rolling Road, to Dogwood, to Holyfield, to Johnny Cake, and back to Woodlawn. And eventually to Dogwood, to Kernan, and to other streets, and then to the burial site. Let's hear how Jay tries to describe these two events in his second interview.
We go back to the 70 parking lot. He gets out of his car, tells me to follow him. He gets into her car. He drives it. We drove around to a whole bunch of different places. Some off of Rowan Road, some off of Dogwood Road. Finally, he goes down past Lincoln Park. No, this is wrong. I'm sorry. I missed something. We leave Christy and Jeff's, and I ask him to drop me off. And we go back to my house, and when we're standing on my porch, that's when he tells me that we have to go back. We have to get rid of the body. We have to get rid of the body.
Jay once again apologizes and says that he missed something. Yeah, he did. He missed number 17 in the chronology. And eventually, he realizes it and goes back and adds it to the story. And that brings us to Christy Vinson and how it is that she came to be part of this whole story. Christy says that Anon and Jay visited her at her place on the 13th, but as we talked about earlier, her memory is actually linked to a different day. So why then does her apartment magically appear in Jay's later interviews? Well, it goes back to those maps, the ones in the police file. In one map, the detectives have the location of a certain cell tower correctly marked. It's a tower that's next to Westview Mall and not too far from Jay's house. And in these maps that the police were using, it also displays the names of fast food restaurants. So right next to where the detectives have the cell tower marked, there's a McDonald's shown too. It's on Rolling Road. And here's what Jay says in his first interview about the phone call that Anon received from Officer Adcock.
When he gets the call from the officer, mm-hmm. Where are you guys? Are you up at the park and ride?
No, we're at a restaurant.
Where exactly? What's the name of the restaurant?
I think we're at McDonald's on Rolling Road.
On McDonald's Rolling Road?
Yeah. At a McDonald's on Rolling Road. We know Jay was lying about this. He admits that he was lying about this. So where did he get such an oddly specific lie from? We can think of one way that he might have come up with it. There's a map of a cell tower that shows right next to it the McDonald's on Rolling Road. In the second interview, though, Jay suddenly says that he was at Christie's when the cops called. In fact, that's apparently the second trip that Jay had made to Christie's that day. He says he was also at Christie's an hour earlier while Anon was still at track practice.
Where do you go? I was on my way home, but then I stopped off at Gilston Park and, I smoked another blunt before I went home, and then I think I may have gone. Yeah, I went to Christian Jeff's, and he called me from the cell phone there, and then I left Christian Jeff's.
Hang on.
So once again, we have a long, awkward J pause. There's a tap, and Jay magically comes up with the right answer. Or, in this case, the wrong answer, because there's absolutely no chance that Jay was hanging out at Christie's place from 4:30 to 5 p.m. that day. But why would the cops prompt Jay to give an incorrect answer? Well, remember that cell tower next to the McDonald's on Rolling Road? There's also a second map showing the area around Christie's apartment. In that map, though, they've taken the tower that was next to McDonald's in the first map, and they've now marked it about 3 miles south, not far from Christie's place. But there isn't a tower there. The cops got it wrong. There's some confusion over the street names, and the cops thought the tower was on the street down by Christie's, so the spot they mistakenly placed it is about a quarter of a mile from her apartment. And this misplaced tower is the one that calls are made on from about 4:30 to 5 o'clock that day. So, the detectives have this map where the cell tower that pings at 4:30 and 5 has been incorrectly placed next to Christie's apartment. And the cops think, well, the phone must be down there next to her apartment because that's what our maps are saying. And they need Jay to comply with their map and to say that, you know, he was at Christie's when those calls were made. And even though he wasn't there and couldn't have been there, Jay complies and tells the detectives that, yeah, he was there at Christie's from 4:30 to 5.
We know this is a pretty serious allegation against the Baltimore Police Department. It's basically saying that they coached Jay into giving the version of events they wanted. But if that sounds like something that could never happen, there was a similar case not too long ago. It involves a defendant by the name of Ezra Mabel, who was convicted of murder. Specifically, the claim was that he killed a drug lord, and he was eventually released from prison and brought a civil case against the Baltimore Police Department, the mayor, and the city. And his claim was that some of the testimony against him was coached, and some of the detectives in that case were the same detectives in this case. According to Mabel, one of the two key eyewitnesses in his case was a woman who, according to the complaint, didn't even see anything having to do with the murder. In fact, it appeared she was either high or drunk during the interview, and the claim in Ezra Mabel's complaint is that she was threatened with being arrested unless she told the police that she had seen the defendant, Ezra Mabel, with a gun exiting the victim's car. And so yes, there are some pretty serious allegations here, but it's not the first time someone's claimed that in a murder case in Baltimore, witnesses against him were coached. Let's note here that on the stand, Jay testified under cross-examination by Gutierrez that, in fact, the police had said to him they would charge him with a murder if he did not become a state's witness. So what we have here then, in layman's terms, is police coaching. Let me say that again. The police coached Jay through his statements. Maybe coaching isn't the right word. Maybe the right expression is that they fed him his statements. They corrected him when he messed up. He apologized repeatedly. They gave him a map. They gave him a chronology to reference. And how did they manage to do that without saying a word so that it never showed up in the transcript? They did it by tapping. What's really frightening, though, is that not only were they able to coach and feed Jay into admitting details that were completely mundane, they took it to the extent that Jay admitted to some really serious stuff because of the coaching. The detectives are repeatedly bullying Jay into giving answers that they want. The detectives will tell Jay that he needs to give a certain answer, and again, Jay complies. He says what they tell him to say, and it's not that subtle either. For example, here's when the detectives are asking Jay about whether, on January 13th, he told Christy, Vincent, and Jeff about Hayes' murder.
If I told him, my exact words would have been that dude killed his girlfriend.
No. Not if you told
him. Okay, I'm sorry.
What did you tell Jeff?
That dude killed his girlfriend.
And what did Jeff say to you?
For real? Oh, snap.
That's it.
This never happened. Jay didn't tell Jeff. Jay testified that this whole scene never occurred, but when the detective asked him to say, quote, what did you tell Jeff, Jay agrees, makes up a story. He even makes up an answer for Jeff.
For real? Oh, snap.
And Jay doesn't just make up stories about who he told about the murder. He makes up stories about much more serious things. In fact, the police got Jay to falsely confess to accessory before the fact to murder, a crime that is itself punishable as murder.
He calls you that night to tell you, I'm going to kill her and I need your assistance.
No. He calls me, wants to know if he can hook up, and then he's going to kill her.
Okay. But you take that as he's going to need your assistance.
Okay, yes.
Okay.
That right there is conspiracy and accessory. Jay agreed to help Adnan with Hayes' murder. And again, we know this didn't happen because that phone call that he's talking about on January 12th was 18 seconds. There's no way that Jay and Adnan discussed relationships, discussed a plan to kill Hay, and discussed where to get weed the next day, all in the space of not even half a minute. So why is Jay confessing to a crime that could put him into jail for life? Crime we're all pretty much sure he knew nothing about. Well, if Jay is willing to make up a story that implicates himself in murder, it's not a stretch that he would also be willing to make up a story to implicate Adnan in that murder. Now, if you really paid attention to this serial, remember that Jen was interviewed by the police first. Twice, in fact, before the police went and picked up Jay. According to Jen, she told Jay that the cops wanted to talk to her, and he told her, you know what? Go ahead and talk to them, and send them to me. Which may make you think, well, if Jen spoke to the cops first, and her story was, you know, similar to Jay's, then maybe he wasn't actually coached. Jen had the same thing to say, kind of. But what if Jay had been speaking to the cops long before they got to Jen, and long before Jay supposedly led them to the car? Did he really lead them to the car? What actual physical evidence really exists in this case? What can the autopsy tell us? How did Hayes' car end up where it was found? What information and evidence did the state hide from the defense? What really was the deal with Gutierrez? For these answers and more, much more on this case, check out the rest of the Adnan Syed stories on our website or your favorite podcast app. You're caught up through episode 3, but don't forget to check out all of other episodes and the addendum episodes for answers to dozens of questions that were left unanswered by others. And of course, check out the many other cases we've covered since we first began airing 5 years ago. There's so much more to this and other stories next time on Undisclosed.
We at Undisclosed don't have the words to express our thanks to all of you, our listeners, for all of your support these past 5 years. And a special thanks from Adnan, myself, and the rest of his loved ones for the support you continue to show him. Thank you to the always masterful Rebecca Lavoie for turning us into pros, to Mito Thalhan for keeping this machine running, to Baluki for our logo, and to Patrick Cortez for our theme music. And I want to personally thank, as we continue this fight, my incredible colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller, who have put in thousands of hours of work on Adnan's case and who we could not have ever come this far without. Also, thank you to the many people who've told his story over the years, Sarah Koenig and Amy Berg and their teams, and to the lawyers who have stood by Adnan all of these years, Chris Floor, Doug Colbert, and Justin Brown. You can find all of our episodes and episode-related documents on our website, www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and don't forget to follow us on social media. You'll find us at Twitter with the handle @undisclosedpod, and we're also on Instagram and Facebook. And finally, if you've enjoyed us all these years, do us a favor and take a little bit of time and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and iTunes.